Saxbury.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Susan Oxford. I represent the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission as appellant in this matter. EEOC acted reasonably when it filed this lawsuit. It acted reasonably when it continued to litigate this lawsuit. And the district court ignored Christiansburg's mandate, clear mandate, not to engage in post hoc reasoning when the district court imposed fees based largely, almost exclusively, on the court's finding that the court's dismissal based on latches. At the outset, although we did not raise this issue below, we urged this court to acknowledge that the district court erred as a matter of law in even considering PROPAC's affirmative defense of latches, because latches is generally not available as an affirmative defense against the government.
Right, but why are we talking about latches here? You didn't appeal the latches determination, and the district court rested its attorney's fee award on whether the EEOC acted unreasonably. Page 10 of its order, acted unreasonably by initiating litigation against PROPAC after an eight-year, well, actually it was less, but the court said eight-year investigation. And so why are we talking about latches? The court was talking about whether the EEOC acted unreasonably. And you never appealed the latches determination on the merits.
The
attorney's fees was based on whether you reasonably acted by initiating the litigation against PROPAC, was right. It not?
And the question of reasonableness, whether our filing the lawsuit was reasonable and continuing to litigate the lawsuit was reasonable. The only arguments PROPAC ever raised and the only issues the district court ever addressed was whether we were reasonable in pursuing this, notwithstanding that PROPAC might assert an affirmative defense of latches and then ultimately did. That's the only basis on which the court assessed reasonableness here. This is not a case about whether EEOC had sufficient evidence before it filed suit to believe that there was actually national origin discrimination.
But the whole thing is we get hung up on the notion, on the particular nomenclature here or the word of latches, but the conclusion that a delay was unreasonable or that a case was litigated unreasonably would stand as an independent conclusion, would it not? So I think one of the really difficult threshold issues is the one Judge Keenan pointed out, and that is the dismissal of the earlier appeal, and you're kind of stuck with the district court's conclusion, aren't you?
We are not, because the fees award requires the court to engage in entirely different analysis. And what is a little confusing here is that the word reasonable or unreasonable appears in both standards, both in the question of latches, it's one of the two elements that a defendant must establish, and in the question of fees, because it's one of the bases in which the court said the limited circumstances in which courts could be imposed on a losing Title VII plaintiff, and that would be that the lawsuit was unreasonable. Now here, the
that the delay was unreasonable, right?
No. Well, Christiansburg says that the fees can be imposed if the lawsuit was unreasonable.
Right.
So here, our lawsuit could only be unreasonable. It could be unreasonable on the merits, but that was never raised by anyone or addressed by the court. So then we look at the only issue that the court ever considered. Was it unreasonable for us to pursue this case because there was a potential latches defense, which PROPAC ultimately did raise?
You're almost arguing for something close to a per se rule that, you know, if this delay isn't unreasonable, aren't we getting very close to a per se rule that you are never, under any circumstances, no matter how dilatory the conduct of the litigation was, that you can never be subject to any sort of attorney's fees?
Absolutely not. Every case stands on its own merits.
But I've never seen one quite this bad.
In terms of what, Your Honor?
In terms of what the district court was talking about. You've got a district court opinion, which is a documented history of extended delay. I'm willing to cut you a reasonable amount of slack, because I know that you have an important mission involved, and I know that EEOC has an investigative division, and it has a litigating division, and sometimes you need to coordinate with that. And I also am trying to be cognizant of the fact that you have a backlog, and probably really always have a very severe backlog, so you've got a lot of different cases to consider at the same time. And so I think those are mitigating factors, but there still comes a point where it just gets to be too much.
Latches requires two elements to be established. Both have to be present.
Well, why are you talking about latches?
Because that is the basis on which the court believed EEOC acted unreasonably, that we pursued...
Well, now show me, if you would, in the court's order, dealing with attorney's fees. The court was talking about whether EEOC acted unreasonably in initiating the litigation, didn't it?
Right. And it examined whether we were unreasonable in initiating the litigation by looking at the very same factors that PROPEC had argued established the latches defense.
Right,
and that
but the
district court
had a
had
different
found-
lens. The court was looking through a different lens in making its award of attorney's fees. And perhaps you could be specific and answer the question, where is there any evidence in the record supporting your contention that you were able to locate claimants who would be entitled to monetary relief?
Oh, I'd be happy to point that out. Yeah. In the chart that the EEOC provided to the district court that has a detailed chronology of the investigation.
Okay, where is that in
that
the record?
That begins on page JA257.
Mm-hmm.
And throughout that, and it might take me a minute to find the specific references, but we indicate where we had spoken to potential claimants and where we had
potential claimants, but anybody who was entitled to monetary relief. Where's there any evidence in this record that you had identified particular people who were entitled to monetary relief?
That's what we mean by potential claimants, and in our view, they're entitled to relief until the.
So you just
proven.
Say that in general, you don't have to.
It's important to remember
there were just
that
potential claimants out there, but that doesn't tell me that there were specific individuals that you had assessed as being entitled to monetary relief.
And that's where it's important to remember the procedural context in which this came before the court. PROPEC filed a motion for summary judgment. The court asked PROPEC if it wanted to engage in any discovery, and PROPEC said no. It declined any discovery. EEOC requested discovery and was given discovery on the issue of prejudice. And so we talked to PROPEC's witnesses about how, if at all, the company was prejudiced by any delay in the EEOC's investigation. But PROPEC chose not to engage in discovery on what EEOC set forth. And by the time PROPEC filed its motion for summary judgment and answered that question about discovery, this was already in the record, this chart we're looking at now, in which EEOC identified various dates on which we spoke to potential claimants.
Potential claimants, that's just a bland reference. I guess what I'm getting at is I'm trying to figure out when you filed this suit, what you thought you possibly could hope to accomplish. The plant had been closed, the managers were off somewhere, who knows where, the employees, there were no particular employees that you knew, or at least the record doesn't support that there were identified employees who were entitled to monetary relief. So what could you have possibly attempted to accomplish? What were you thinking when you filed the complaint that you were going to be able to do? Injunctive remedy wasn't going to work. The plant was closed. So what reason was this litigation filed?
This litigation
as supported by this record?
This litigation was filed to obtain back pay damages for individuals who had applied for jobs and been denied their jobs because they were not Hispanic.
Right, but is there anything in this record that shows that you had identified individuals? You said
yes.
You spoke to potential claimants, but that doesn't support that there actually were people that you had ascertained were eligible for relief.
And if it was EEOC's burden to disprove latches, perhaps we would have had to offer more than we did. But for summary judgment purposes, where what we allege is assumed to be true, and PROPEC chose not to challenge or test that, on JA 263,
right,
for instance.
What were you planning to accomplish when you filed the complaint? You said monetary damages, but you have no idea that there were, or we don't have any idea that there were any, you'd ascertained that any identifiable individual.
On JA 263, there are two entries, and this is just an example. There are more in this eight-page chronology. Interview notes, which we identified as privileged, where we spoke to potential class members. And there are other times when we did the same, and they're indicated
right
throughout this eight-page.
I guess what we're doing is quibbling a little here, and maybe I don't understand, and Ms. Oxford, maybe you can help me then. You're saying it's just enough to say you spoke to potential people.
When we filed this lawsuit,
you don't have to say you ascertained that some of these potential people, in fact, did have claims that could be litigated successfully.
That is correct, because whether or not we had a factual basis for filing this lawsuit, a sufficient basis, was never tested. It was never challenged by PROPEC. It was never tested. The court acknowledged that we had identified potential claimants in the early pages of its decisions, and then later said the class no longer existed and it was unclear or doubtful that EEOC could find these people. There's no basis for that.
You know, what we're contesting is an award of attorney's fees, and you rightly, I think, refer to the Christiansburg decision, but there's, another line of Supreme Court decisions which says the one thing we don't want is a second major litigation over attorney's fees. And that's what we have here. And the district court order on the attorney's fees, he didn't just brush it off. The amount isn't even in dispute. And he made about as careful a set of findings on the point of attorney's fees as I've seen district courts make. Now, you can dispute whether the time prior to the initiation of suit was 6.5 years or whether it was 8 years or whatever. But this is a very careful district court order. And he meticulously goes through the timeline of the case and documents all those periods where the case languishes and where it just seems to die. And if this order is insufficient and this record of delay is insufficient, aren't we taking away from district courts one of their mechanisms of control, which is in order for them to have a reasonable amount of authority over the litigants before them and over the case, they need to be the ones, because they've lived with the case, to have some discretion in that attorney's fee award? That's what the standard of review does. And so if we reverse on this, not only would we be generating more appeals for ourselves, but we'd be pulling a rug out from under district judges who've lived with the case for a long time and who, in this case, there's nothing careless about this order. This is from a judge who's been with the case for 3 years, not the entirety of it, but he's been with it for 3 years, going through each period and documenting periods of delay. Now, what is wrong with that?
Your Honor, there are a number of things that are very wrong with this. There are legal errors which we think are very critical for this court to recognize and reverse, and there are clear factual errors. Starting on page 18 of our reply brief, we explain how the district court erred in the way it analyzed our investigation. It took the position that it could second guess not just how many months or weeks might have passed between one step and another, but even the sequence of events that the EEOC conducted its investigation. That is completely inconsistent with this court's jurisprudence to defer to the EEOC in the conduct of its investigative matters.
That, again, it seems to go to the merits of whether latches applied in this case. And I guess your point is that there's a separate analysis that the district court needs to conduct with respect to the attorney fee issue. It's not enough to say, well, maybe it is. Maybe this is the case where these issues tend to merge, as Judge Wilkins seemed to suggest. But there's a separate analysis whether or not your client acted unreasonably with respect to the litigation. That's been decided. The court decided that the latches defense applied. But then there's a separate question of whether or not the district court reasoned correctly that your client had a reasonable basis for asserting the latches defense applied. That's a separate issue.
Absolutely.
And that's what you're saying, is that the court ignored or didn't apply the correct test.
That's exactly what we're saying.
But Judge Wilkerson seems to be saying in this case that effectively those tests merge because you have such an egregious set of facts here that the result wouldn't change even if the correct test were to be applied.
My time is up. May I answer the question?
Oh, sure.
First of all, the question about whether our lawsuit was unreasonable and whether that is tied into the factors on which the court found the delay was unreasonable, that only goes to one prong of the latches defense. So the second question would be, doesn't merge entirely, because for it to be unreasonable for us to go forward with this lawsuit, we had to have known that it would be a certainty we would lose on the latches defense. That would make it unreasonable if it was a certainty, but in fact it wasn't, because a defendant must also establish prejudice. And on these facts, this court has never issued a decision that would say on these facts where PROPEC never attempted to locate the witness that says it was so critical.
How can a company not be prejudiced when, as a result of the delay, the plant is closed and the witnesses are scattered to the winds?
Your Honor, in other circuits...
How can that not be prejudiced?
The Seventh Circuit has essentially ruled that way, but this court in Radiator Specialty said that you cannot just assume prejudice. It can't be based on general allegations. It has to be proved specifically.
They were talking of, there's no general allegation. The plant is closed. The relevant witnesses are who knows where.
Exactly, because PROPEC never tried to find them. And the Third Circuit said if you haven't even tried to find your witnesses, you cannot claim prejudice based on their unavailability. Right. They're not unavailable.
But the district court found, as a matter of fact, did it not, in its judgment order, that you couldn't even identify the class of victims. And you haven't said why that's clearly erroneous. And if you can't even, if we're bound by that factual finding, that the class of victims could not be identified, then how could the litigation have been reasonably initiated if you didn't even have a class of victims?
First of all, identified? I'd like to go back and just call the court's attention to the fact that in our reply brief, not only do we start at page 18 to talk about how the court erroneously critiqued our investigation, but starting at page 24, we list specific factual errors.
Right, but if you could answer this question,
and
how
this
do
question,
you get beyond that factual finding at the bottom of page 10 in the district court's order?
We identified individuals who would be members of our class, and had it ever come to the point where PROPEC asked us in interrogatories to identify who our class members were, the individuals we spoke to at various points that are all noted in the 8-page chronology, those are the individuals we had identified. But for latches purposes, it is not EEOC's burden to disprove
the latches.
I'm not
talking about latches. I'm talking about, is it reasonable to file a lawsuit if you don't even know who your victims are?
Correct. We knew who our victims were.
The court said you didn't.
I know. The court was clearly erroneous on that point.
Okay, so tell us why that is clearly erroneous.
We did not identify people by name because we were never asked to, but we listed in our chronology the dates on which we spoke to individuals. They were the members. They're a potential claimant until the court orders money to be paid to them. Then they become a claimant. We had identified these individuals. We were never asked to do more than what we did. On summary judgment, the court was obligated to take as true our representation that we identified individuals.
No, and in not fact, to take as true. It gives you the benefit of inferences, but you're reciting a 12b-6 stuff.
For summary judgment, this is the evidence we put into the record for summary judgment purposes.
To the assertion that it's all true. You have to create a genuine issue of fact.
And PROPEC did not say that we couldn't identify individuals.
Let me
I
ask
believe
you one
that.
Other thing,
yes.
And that is, when you delay as long as you do in this case, doesn't it disadvantage the plaintiff's side of the case? Doesn't the plaintiff have the same interest that the defendant does in in having the case prosecuted and having some, and if there is a remedy at the end of the road, having that remedy put in place. I come again to the fact that I think Congress has imbued you with a very important mission. But if you delay this long and proceed the way the litigation has here, doesn't this harm the very people whom Congress wanted you to protect? I mean, how long does Mr. talk about prejudice? The plaintiffs here are going to be prejudiced. Who knows where they're going to be? Some of them may not even be alive if the litigation goes on as long as this does. Don't they have, in this instance, the same interest in prompt adjudication that a defendant might?
There are many natural pressures that would keep the EEOC moving forward as quickly as possible. We complete every investigation as quickly as possible, and we know that evidence can disappear, witnesses can become unavailable, and memories can fade. So we have every reason to complete investigations as quickly as possible and to get into court, and we did that here. And this case is not going forward, so we don't need to worry. Yeah.
The one question I have, Ms. Oxford, is are all these time lapses where the case just languishes for months on end, and in some cases for over a year before anything at all happens, and there's these periods where the relevant people, the supervisors and the plaintiff himself and some of the other relevant witnesses are never talked to for just months on an end, and the whole question of class certification, the district court made a finding that you decided to proceed on this as a class action, but the defendant wasn't even informed for a period of years, perhaps 4 years, before that decision was even communicated to the defendant. I mean, that can't be the way litigation is supposed to proceed.
Your Honor, that is another one of the factual errors of the district court that's clearly erroneous, that's refuted by the record. PROPEC itself did not even allege that it had no notice this was a class investigation.
I tried to find out why these things were clearly erroneous, and I couldn't. That seemed to me that the district court was correct.
Also pending before this court is EEOC's motion, dual motion, to supplement the record with three documents that were before the district court and that PROPEC received and responded to, the three requests for information, and for this court to take judicial notice of three other documents that are a matter of public record. And those documents show that throughout the entire investigation, PROPEC was well aware that we were investigating class allegations of non-hiring based on national origin. PROPEC responded to that. PROPEC gave us over 10,000 documents that had nothing to do with Mr. Quintos's individual claim that as a manager, he was fired after 2 months. These only had to do with EEOC's class investigation. PROPEC received our request for information, the dates of which are detailed in this same chronology, and documents were before the district court. They received those, they responded to them, that's why they gave us 10,000 documents to talk about the hiring decisions that they made, the individuals who applied and those who were selected and those who were rejected. The only
Do you think you might want to take up some of this in rebuttal?
Yes, certainly, Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Cole.
May it please the court, John Cole for PROPEC Logistics. Contrary to the impression given by the EEOC in their varied arguments, this appeal concerns one very narrow issue, whether the district court abused its discretion when it awarded attorney's fees to PROPAC. Notably, there are two ways in which this court can affirm the award of attorney's fees. First, this court must affirm if it finds that the trial court did not abuse its discretion in concluding that the initiation of litigation was unreasonable. And second, this court must affirm if it finds that the trial court did not abuse its discretion in concluding that the continued prosecution of the lawsuit was unreasonable. Now, a trial court's discretion...
That suggests that in every case where a district judge finds a laches defense, that as a matter of law, a plaintiff is entitled to attorney's fees. That's not your position, is it?
That's not our position. Position.
I mean, that's precisely the point, right? Doesn't the district court have to segregate its ruling on the merits and separate that, not entirely, because the facts are relevant to the issue of whether or not it was reasonable to oppose the laches defense, but that's a separate inquiry. And I guess my concern is whether or not the district judge was very thorough, there's no question about it, but I'm concerned about whether or not the court actually boxed those in its separate compartments as it was required to do.
I think the court did, Your Honor. It correctly cited the standard, the Title VII fee statute. It understood it had discretion. It cited Christianberg and the standard, frivolous, unreasonable, or groundless. It set a great stakes, and the standard this court has pronounced in great stakes, whether the EEOC knew or should have known when it initiated the litigation that it was unreasonable. And then it went ahead and applied the facts to those standards. It held that the law of the case was that the EEOC's delay in the investigation was unreasonable, and two, that delay prejudiced PROPAC. But that it did not say that the law of the case was laches, therefore I must award fees. It understood it had discretion, and it went through the standard under Christianberg and great stakes and looked at various factors and under the totality of the circumstances, the abundance of factors. It awarded fees under its discretion. Now,
I think my colleague makes a good point in that they are distinct questions, and you can't just say, well, Lash's attorney's fees. You have to unpack it, and I guess your response here is in the right at the beginning of the discussion. He says, "This is law of the case that the EEOC's delay in the investigation was unreasonable, and that PROPAC was materially prejudiced thereby." But interestingly enough, the district court doesn't just say, oh, well, it's the law of the case.
That's correct.
The order goes on to explain what, if it was strictly laches or law of the case, the district court wouldn't even have had to do. But the district court goes on at great length to document why, in its view, the pursuit of the litigation, the investigation and the pursuit once suit was filed was unreasonable. So I think that there was an independent conclusion, even in view of the law of the case, there was an independent analysis undertaken and an independent conclusion taken, and it was under the rubric of unreasonableness. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting to me is in reading this district court order, maybe I'm wrong, it certainly wasn't the emphasis of the district court order, but I can't find that the word laches is even used in this district court order. I looked through at least the critical pages of the discussion, which run from page 6 of the district court order to probably 12 or 13. I don't find that the word laches was used, but what it seemed to be doing was discussing it under the heading of unreasonableness, and I think that was what he had to do. The latches thing is, it's one thing, but I've maybe a bit of a red herring in the case, because I don't know that latches can be interposed against the sovereign. I don't know. There's a big debate about that. I'm just not sure we need to enter it, both because the EEOC dismissed the earlier appeal and also because the way I look at the attorney's fees thing in Christiansburg, it's more of a discussion of unreasonableness on the merits and whether prejudice resulted from that.
I agree, Your Honor.
Because Christiansburg itself doesn't mention latches.
Christiansburg, I agree, Your Honor. I agree with that. Christiansburg focuses on the frivolousness, unreasonableness, or groundless of the plaintiff's claim, or that the claim became frivolous, unreasonable, or groundless after the lawsuit was initiated.
I just think it was a little bit of a red herring. Everybody was getting all caught up in the label, and and when I read the order, I didn't see latches, and then when I read Christiansburg, I didn't see a whole lot of discussion about latches, and yet the briefs were just all on fire about latches, and to me, I don't understand.
Well, our position it certainly has been that Judge Reitinger's ruling was independent of the latches summary judgment ruling, independent and not constrained by that. Now, we did argue in our motion for fees. I tried to push the judge to say, because we prevailed on latches.
Well, he does refer on page 12 of the order to latches, and he does it in the limited context of saying there is prejudice to PROPAC, doesn't he? I mean, you can't say that he makes no reference to latches.
Limited reference.
Right. He makes a limited reference with
regard
to prejudice.
Well, you're correct, Your Honor. He did reference that the prior ruling, he ruled previously that EEOC was guilty of latches. Mm-hmm. And that was the summary judgment order. That was the final order. The EEOC initially appealed it, and then they abandoned it.
What do you think about the allegation that contention that the Soxford is making that the court's findings were clearly erroneous?
I don't think there's any support for that argument in the record. The factual findings.
Why do you think they were correct?
They were supported by the record. All the factual findings were supported by the record, and ample support by the record. And to me, what the EEOC is doing is basically just disagreeing with the judge. And that doesn't show abuse of discretion or clearly erroneous.
She says that you can't claim prejudice if you made no attempt to locate the witnesses. And what do you say about that?
That's an inaccurate statement, that we made no attempt to locate the witnesses. When the EEOC deposed, conducted at Rule 30B6 of PROPAC, the deponent said essentially that it didn't know where to begin, that it thought about it, but the plant had closed in 2008. All the employees were terminated. The managers that were in charge of the hiring decisions had left in 05 and 06. The allegations concerned alleged discriminatees in 02 and 04. It knew not where to begin. The records, they followed their document retention policy. There weren't any personnel records. The plant was closed. The managers had long gone. All the employees were gone.
Why did you hand them 10,000 pages of documents? Was that necessary?
That was before I represented the client, Your Honor. But, they tried to comply with the EEOC's investigation, but the investigation, I've never seen anything like that. Nearly 7 years, and I've been doing this a long time, and even the EEOC's chronology notes significant periods of where nothing was done to further the investigation. I mean, essentially radio silence, just no communication, nothing. And that's their own chronology. And even the EEOC admitted that...
There's a dispute over whether it was 6.5 years or 8 years.
Well, it's close to 7, Your Honor. I think what the judge was referring to when he mentioned the 8 years was from the time the initial charge was filed in 03 until the time the depositions were conducted in 2011.
There was one other question I wanted to ask you because Ms. Oxford brought it up. She says you all were really aware of the class status of the action. You say, well, they made a decision and we didn't learn of it until 4 years later. And she says, no, you knew it all along. What do you have to say about that?
The record shows that the first notification the EEOC gave PROPAC that it was pursuing this as a class case was September 2008. The record's very firm on that.
The district court made a finding on that point.
Yes, Your Honor, and he was correct. That's an accurate fact.
Again, it worries me because with a delay of this length, it seems to me that both sides are hurt. And we're talking here about prejudice to the defendant, and that should certainly be pursued because that's the element that you need in attorney's fees. But as a practical matter also, it's not just the defendant that's prejudiced. What concerns me is these long, long delays. If you were a plaintiff and were bringing a suit, or the EEOC was bringing a suit on your behalf, as happened here, and they were in charge of this litigation, it would seem to me to work to the detriment of plaintiffs and defendants to have a delay stretch out at this length.
I absolutely agree, Your Honor. Look at Quintos, the charging party. He got so frustrated with the EEOC, he asked them 4 separate occasions for an update or his right to sue letter. And finally, he got one after 4 attempts, and being basically ignored by the EEOC. He got a right to sue and filed his own lawsuit. And that case was dismissed. So even the charging party got frustrated in this instance. And it just did. It was the hardship on the company. It's hard for me to describe that. It really fought the fight for a long, long time. And many of my clients would not have done that. It fought the EEOC on this investigation. It fought Quintos in his lawsuit. That was dismissed. It had to defend against the Department of Justice related investigation. That was found to be without merit.
Did the Department of Justice say that there was nothing to this?
That's correct, Your Honor. Dismissed.
The EEOC still went ahead.
Yes.
In thinking about agency behavior here, they do have an important mission, and they do have a horrific backlog. And they do have, sometimes in order for an agency to act, they have to get permission from this department and this department. And then there's a bifurcation often between an investigative function and a litigating function, and all of those. Are agencies do a little bit more slack than an ordinary litigant because of these?
I don't believe so,
Your Honor.
They
have more resources. But
I don't believe so. I mean,
why not? Why wouldn't an agency?
Well, Christiansburg.
Why wouldn't an agency under Christiansburg be cut a little bit more slack than a private litigant?
Well, Christiansburg doesn't make that distinction between an agency and a regular plaintiff. And I don't think we should give them slack to promote bringing unreasonable lawsuits, which this case clearly was. I mean, we're not.
Is there any other case out there? Are there many other cases? Any other cases out there with facts that are quite like these?
I didn't find any, Your Honor. This was a very unique case. particular facts to it. There's no plant, no employees, no records, no managers, and an investigation going on for almost 7 years.
Are there any other cases where there was a delay of this length before bringing suit, or whether
we cited some cases in our summary judgment brief where there were cases that
case
last
almost,
long than ours.
This case almost sui generis in its facts.
It could be. I mean, it's. I don't think the court should be concerned about here in having the implication that latches equals fees, because the court didn't go there, but it was an egregious case, and the court did independently go through the factors that led to it to conclude, in exercising its discretion, that the prosecution of the case was unreasonable and its continued litigation of the case was unreasonable. After it got the discovery, it insisted upon the judge appropriately stated that the EEOC reaffirmed for the EEOC what it already knew or should have known, that PROPAC was clear of the prejudice. There's no facility, no employees.
And when you say unreasonable, you're talking unreasonable with respect to delay and with respect to the sheer lack of merit, because there could be a case where the plaintiff has a meritorious claim, there's evidence to support it, but the defendant has been prejudiced in asserting defenses because of the delay. This case seems to implicate both of these separate prongs. That is, a lack of merit for the reasons Judge Keenan question the EEOC about, and on top of that, the delay. Is that your point?
Yes, Your Honor, I think that accurately sums up our argument. The delay was unreasonable, and the continued prosecution was unreasonable also, and I think...
But to come back at the bottom of it all to... come back to where Judge Keenan started. Who are the people that are going to recover?
Exactly. It was uncertain whether any potential discriminatees could even be located.
So you have, in your view, the delay, the prejudice, and the absence of underlying merit.
Yes, Your Honor. Delay, prejudice, and just no merit to the case from the outset.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor. Yeah,
we don't have any further questions.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May I have rebuttal?
Oh, of course.
Okay, thank you.
Absolutely.
EEOC was never asked to identify its claimants by anyone, not by PROPAC, not by the court. And since this came before the court on a motion to dismiss for latches, it was PROPAC's affirmative obligation to prove its defense. We were never asked and never required to identify our claimants. The court
wouldn't
simply,
you want to do that in the natural course?
If we move to the merits, if we move beyond latches and move to the merits of the case, then PROPAC would undoubtedly have served interrogatories on us, asking us to identify the individuals on whose behalf we sought relief, and we would have identified those individuals by name then. But at this posture, under summary judgment, what's in the record is completely adequate to demonstrate that EEOC knew there were claimants on whose behalf we would seek back pay.
Well, even at this date, can you identify a single concrete individual who had a...
We have the records of the individuals we spoke to back then. I don't know if we haven't looked for them since. This case has now been in litigation for 4+ years beyond that on this separate question of latches, and so we haven't continued to keep up with the location of these individuals, but we have interview notes that we notate are confidential here, are privileged, that have the names and contact information for those individuals. That's not the issue before this court, however, and I want to just really focus the court's attention, if I may, on what are the possible grounds for a court to award fees based on unreasonableness. If you look at most of the decisions awarding fees to plaintiffs, or this court has several times reversed fees that have been awarded against losing plaintiffs, you look at the facts that would establish the discrimination claim, and this court has said where a plaintiff lost on their Title VII claim, but they had offered some evidence in support of it, even though not enough to prevail, this court has reversed attorney's fees. This court has affirmed fees only where there was absolutely no evidence. That's not this case, though, because we're not looking at the merits.
This case didn't only go off on that. This case went off on the
on a legal question
and the prejudice that arose from the delay, plus questions about the underlying merit and where those people who would benefit from a judgment on the merit.
That's where I'd like to take issue with Your Honor. This case went off on the question of whether PROPEC could establish its affirmative defense of latches. That's the basis on which it was dismissed. And when the court then turned to examine whether fees should be awarded because EEOC's case was unreasonable, the court could not properly look at the question of reasonableness as in a prudential consideration, a prosecutorial discretion about whether to pursue this case or not. That could not be the basis for the court's award of fees. So to the extent the court thought that perhaps we shouldn't go after a company that has that is still operating but not at that location, we have many times around the country sued a company that closed at a particular location or had closed entirely because of discrimination that happened before the company closed. And there's nothing wrong with our doing that. We perfectly have the legal right to do that. We have sought back pay relief for individuals who couldn't get in statement because the operations were closed. There's nothing wrong with seeking back pay for those individuals. So the court could not have thought that we were unreasonable for going after a company that had closed one of its many nationwide operations.
No, he didn't, but it thought you were unreasonable for going after someone when you didn't know who the victims were.
And the court was just wrong on that. That's plainly erroneous. But if you look at Christiansburg and compare that.
You said the court was clearly erroneous on about 10 different things.
And that's it.
Couldn't have been that bad.
If Your Honor would look at their record carefully, you would see that it was, in fact, that bad. The court just made up facts. It actually acknowledged things as true and then found the contrary in its decision with no basis in the record whatsoever. If I could just end by noting these similarities with the Christiansburg case. That case was dismissed not on any basis that related to the merits of EEOC's race discrimination claim against the Christiansburg Garment Company, but because EEOC brought suit in 1974 relying on a charge that had already been closed when we got our litigation authority in 1972. And the district court said we were too late to sue on behalf of that charging party, that the statutory authority to sue didn't extend to that, and this court affirmed. But the district court denied fees, and this court affirmed on that basis too, and the Supreme Court said that although we were absolutely wrong in our interpretation of the statute, it was a question that warranted judicial determination. And that is the same thing with latches. There is no decision of this court that would have signaled to EEOC that we should have known it was unreasonable to pursue this case on these facts.
Aren't we in the middle of a second major litigation over attorney's fees, which the Supreme Court said is the very thing we don't want, and here we are.
The court made that comment in response to the amount of fees and said there shouldn't be a second major litigation around the accounting and the allocation of the exact amounts.
You don't contest the amount.
Pardon?
You haven't contested the amount.
That's correct. And so the Supreme Court has never said that parties should not be allowed to pursue the legal bases on which attorneys' fees were improperly imposed. And that is what we'd like to ask your court to look at our briefs again, where we outline numerous legal errors as well as clearly erroneous facts and an outright abuse of the district court's decision.
But basically, the decision whether to award attorneys' fees as well as an amount, it's kind of a judgment call. Both of them are judgment calls. And you, you can't see the Supreme Court saying, well, it's okay to have a second major litigation over whether attorney's fees should be awarded, but we just don't want a second. We just don't want a second litigation over amount. I mean, the point is one of the chief things a district judge does is allocate and award attorney's fees. It's one of a number of mechanisms by which district courts quite literally maintain control of their courts. It doesn't mean they can be arbitrary about it. That's the thing. You don't want them just snapping off judgments or being arbitrary, but district judge here, and I think we all recognize that, it's a conscientious job. He wasn't trying to rule from the bench or snap out a one-page order or whatever.
As conscientious as he may have been,
He did not
correctly apply Christiansburg's very limited standards for awarding fees against a losing plaintiff.
Ms. Oxford, we thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll adjourn court and come down and I was going to say award attorney's fees, but we're going to come down and shake hands.
This honorable court stands adjourned until tomorrow morning at 9:30. God save the United States and this honorable court.